Welcome back to the Growth Innovators Podcast. The consumer goods industry is experiencing a massive retail to virtual shift that is redefining how new brands and products go to market. Soaring digital distribution techniques and the rising ease of manufacturing are largely to thank, as both capitalize on the digital arena at large and embrace this virtual first shift. As businesses are shifting their go-to-market strategies to embrace the potential of digital, the question remains, how do you create a consumer goods brand faster, better, and cheaper? In this discussion, Manifold advisory partner John Sfiocla chats with Steve Salzinger, Managing Director of Salzinger LLC, and they discuss some of the opportunities brought about by changes in digital distribution, the rising ease of manufacturing, and the foundational requirements for launching a digital brand faster, cheaper, and better. It's an interesting conversation. I think you'd get a lot out of it. And with that, let's go to John and Steve.
Hello, everybody. John Sfiocla here with my dear friend, Steve Salzinger. I am delighted today to have a chance to talk with Steve about launching digital brands in the new world. Steve and I have known each other for a long time. Steve was a research associate when I was at Harvard Business School back in the mid-1990s. And he and I were working together on some really concepts that we call managing in the market space, exploring the virtual value chain, along with our colleague, Jeff Rayport. And so it's a delight. Steve actually went and built a company and he's an amazing advisor to private equity and Fortune 500 companies around digital marketing and so forth. And he's in the middle of launching a new product called RescueMD, which is a fantastic new product that helps with skin damage and with scars and has some great new technology and is living what we're going to be talking about today, which is launching new brands. So he's both helped existing organizations as well as launching his own. So we're going to have some real on the ground expertise here. And I can do a little bit of an introduction, but welcome, Steve. It's great to have you, man.
Oh, John, it's great to be here. It's so nice to see you again. It has been a while. It's been over 25 years.
Too long. Too long. Yeah. Well, we'll have to do it again before the next 25. Right. Whatever. But let me take you through what we're going to go through. I just went through Steve's background and what we're going to be talking about today. And I really wanted to highlight why it's important for folks, both who are launching digital brands as well as existing companies, to understand what's going on here, to really highlight some of the differences that happen in a cloud-based digital set of relationships that we're looking at now. Very different economics, very different brand building strategies and so forth. And then, of course, look at the next one's speaker. Let me give you a background in terms of Manifold. So Manifold, we are a venture holding company. We think of it this way. We help build 21st century platform companies in the venture part of our business. And then in the consulting part of our business, we help 20th century companies become more digitally enabled to compete in the 21st century. And we generally serve owners, so private equity or family-owned businesses or founders, although we occasionally deal with publicly traded companies as well. And then our studios business helps us build technology, both sides of that equation. So it's a fun business and a growing space. We call it growth engineering, and we've served some large companies and small ones. You can see Kindred and Coca-Cola, PwC, and so forth as folks that we've helped. One concept I repeat as we go through this, this probably makes me a really dull guy, but I'm fascinated by this concept. And the fundamental thing, this is an insight actually I had back when I didn't call it exactly this, but insight I had back when I first started working with Steve, that the world is getting more and more digitized. Alan Turing and Alonzo Church, separately but at the same time, in 1938, came up with the idea of a symbol processing machine. And at that point, basically anything that could be described in symbols could be put onto this logical machine, what's called the Turing machine. And this thing we're talking to you over is a Turing machine, philosophically and conceptually. And it basically is a symbol system that can process symbols and deliver them in a robust way repeatedly. And so this birth, and that was the big bang, if you will, of the digital universe in my mind. And so that gets us to this law of computability. So what's going on? If you say all the different things are going on, we have, you know, digital marketing, we have digital twins, we have AI, all that other stuff. The fundamental phenomenon underneath that, I believe, is a thing I call the law of computability. So if you have deep level of knowledge of a task, and that task is highly digitized, you can usually compute it. So you look at something like a flight simulator for teaching somebody how to fly. We have great knowledge of the physics of an airplane and how it reacts. And we can digitize living daylights out, so you can compute that. The human body, not so much. There's certain things that we understand. There's a lot of things that we don't. So the human body is not computable. Flight is. Certain parts of medicine are. Some aren't. That's the phenomenon. And if you are ahead on understanding computability, you get better economics, better quality, better scalability, and better returns on capital. So it's a very important thing. And I think what we're talking about today, launching new brands, is an example of that kind of computability. So again, a little geeky. I think it's, I'm trying to get at what's the kind of unified field theory underneath that, although that's a big word to put on this thing. We're going to get very deep into this concept, which is, and I wrote a little thing on LinkedIn about this a couple of days ago. I think I'm haunted by this wonderful phrase or concept that Jim Cash, who I taught with at Harvard Business School, said, and really stuck with me. He said, look, the only sustainable competitive advantage, the only sustainable competitive advantage is a superior management process. And what we have here with the OODA loop, which stands for Observe, Orient, Decide, and Act, Observe, Orient, Decide, and Act, was popularized by a guy by the name of John Boyd, Colonel John Boyd, who started in the Korean War, then was in the Vietnam War. And he was a revolutionary theorist and fighter pilot who had a bet, standing bet with anybody, and he taught at a flight school, so he had a lot of comers, that he could get aerial superiority over them in 40 seconds or less, or he would pay them $40. And he never lost a bet. And it's because he could observe, orient, decide, and act faster than the competition. And we're going to talk a little bit about that as you launch digital brands, because I think that you're getting inside that for the customer and for the competition when you're launching a digital brand. So let me stop there. Steve, welcome. And Steve, what I would love to start with is tell me about how anyone who has been a brand marketer before what you're doing today needs to change and think about what it means to launch brands in this new environment.
One of my favorite stories that I experienced was I was with a Fortune 500 CMO probably 10 years ago now. And he said to me, what I don't know anymore is anything about advertising. This is a CMO of a major CPG company. And he said, I used to produce an ad. I would run it on television. Yes. And then 6 to 9 months later, they would tell me how it did and how it performed. Today, I launch an ad, and in 15 minutes, if I messed up,
right,
I have a line of people outside my door. And fundamentally, the speed with which business is occurring in the consumer space has just accelerated from 9 months to 15 minutes.
I mean, look, you've done a lot of consulting to existing branded companies and so forth. How do they absorb that new speed? I think one of the hardest things to do is to adopt a new management process. I mean, how do those organizations deal with it? And what are the kinds of things that you see are the challenges?
Well, it runs the gamut. It runs the gamut from completely setting up parallel organizations where they'll hire a third party to run everything that requires immediate turnaround. Some companies outsource it to India, and others try to do it internally by retraining their existing marketing teams to adapt to a new pace of business. In both instances, it's extremely challenging because it's such a deep cultural change to the organizations.
And so you centered on the cultural change. So is that cultural change, let's decompose that a little bit. I mean, I would think, let me take a guess and tell me if this is right, that in addition to underneath the cultural change, just the technology, that is, do we have the ability to sense and respond and model the customer? There's the skills, that is, do I really understand, you know, what it means to have a dominant presence and a great look and feel on Instagram and then get the feedback and feed into that environment? And then there's just the management processes and rewards and so forth, right? Because, gee, if I'm getting feedback in 15 minutes, the way I get rewarded as a marketing executive, I imagine needs to look a whole lot different than, hey, look, you had an award-winning Clio winning ad. Fantastic. You're great. Great response kind of a thing. So that notion of technology skills and rewards, is that, are those underneath some of that cultural stuff?
So it's underneath some of the cultural stuff. And if you look about what makes up those processes, those systems, those rewards, it's all about people. And it's all about the ability to get the right skills applied to the new tasks. And what's happened is so many of these tasks, for example, measuring and monitoring if your advertising is working, mm-hmm. right? It used to be to understand what was happening, the velocity on the shelves, and understanding how that was being tied back to the 50% of your advertising that was working and the 50% that was not working. And now you're in a world where you have tremendous math behind the ability to do prediction in the identification of where your customers are, mm-hmm. the ability to build awareness and measure awareness in real time,
yeah.
The ability to bring people into the funnel of converting them, and then the ability to then understand through all these sophisticated CRM technologies, what's the right way to nurture relationships over time. Mm-hmm. And so the culture has become so much more based on the ability to blend the math and the skills of the data analytics mm-hmm. together with the meaning of the brand. And that's a very difficult transition for companies that have been working differently for so many decades.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting that I forget which of the advertisers said 50% of my, I've seen it attributed to different folks, but 50% of my advertising is wasted. I don't know which 50%. But I mean, now, I mean, back to this notion of the law of computability or whatever, and if you, I don't know if you've seen the movie A Social Network, and I know that you've read Shoshana Zuboff's book on the surveillance economy. Basically, I would say that for lots of things, we're actually computing individual and collective cognition, like what's my desire set, right? And predicting that, and then splicing our offer right into the middle of that. Is that a fair way to think about it?
That is a very fair way to think about it. And that is 50% of the equation, okay. Which is that real-time analytics to optimize your interaction with a brand every step of the way.
Yeah.
The other 50% is the visual communication, the words. What are you saying about your product? What are you intending to communicate regarding concepts of authenticity, concepts of bringing reviews and ratings from people who are providing feedback in real time?
Yes.
Not only to you, but to each other.
Yes.
And so the 50% of the technology is what you can control, but the other 50% is what you overlay on that technology related to your individual brand mm-hmm. that floats in the ether of your brand meaning and floats out there in Instagram and YouTube and ties into your advertising. And what's happened, especially within the last few years, is it's become a race to blend together the creative communication and direct marketing expertise that frankly has been around for the past 100 years with this highly computable digital infrastructure.
Yeah.
And that's where distinction comes in. That's where you can really differentiate yourself.
Well, that sounds like a really new art form. You know, I'm reminded of living here in Chicago now because most of my adult kids are out here and our only grandchild is out here instead of Massachusetts where I was born and raised. And I'm reminded of the great Marshall Fields, who was a early retailer. And he had the genius of really redesigning instead of those simple store shelves, right, to bring someone into bring someone into a wealthy person's home. He had the world's first escalator in a retail location. He had the world's largest chandelier. Just that notion of bringing people into opulence and having all this in a physical location sounds similar to the kind of blending you're talking about, which is really what is the new creative spark in the context of measurement and modeling.
Absolutely. And the concept of luxury in digital is really fascinating because you think about what a great website used to look like 20 years ago.
Sure.
You've Got Mail, and you look at what a luxury experience is today, and it's immersive. And I believe from a creative execution standpoint, they've figured out ways to convey meaning through visual experience, through user experience design, through visual imagery. And there are ways to really bring the consumer into that world across multiple platforms, and enabling that consistency across platforms, both in the physical world and the digital world, is really as much of an art as it is a science. It's a fascinating new world. It's more complicated than a big box store used to be.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, I'm reminded of the stuff you and I worked on so long ago about marketplace, market space. And for those of you who haven't had the luxury of reading our article, it talked about content, context, and infrastructure, and physical and virtual, right? And that continuity of context of that buying environment, no matter where you're getting touched, Instagram or YouTube or in the store, or whatever, right? Yeah, it's a challenge. And you're saying, hey, that's actually making that work in the real world, especially for organizations that didn't grow up that way, is a lot of work. Hey, Steve, could I ask you to be a little promotional for a minute? Tell us about your company and about what RescueMD is doing and like where you are on the journey and what you're doing and discovering.
Sure. Happy to. So I was working as an operating partner at a private equity fund about 5 years ago and saw that there was this opportunity that was emerging in the world around what I would call niche brands that were focusing on very small markets that had very low innovation. And so I went on a journey, and I've been on this journey for about 5 years, to find a market that was underserved by innovation and underserved by technology. Uh-huh. And I met a plastic surgeon, a gentleman by the name of Dr. Michael Sussman, who was working on innovating in the scar care space for his post-surgical patient experience. And it was fascinating. He had put together this great product. And over the next couple of years, I started to formulate with a manufacturer some proprietary ingredients into the scar care formula, and was able to, from a process standpoint, very little capital investment, put together an absolutely beautiful and highly efficacious scar product that has an exclusive ingredient and has never been on the market before. And so that product is this. I'm not going to do too much promotion, but this is RescueMD. And what we were able to do is basically with a staff of 1.5 people, launch this product into the market, RescueMD.com, a luxury scar and skin damage product. We were able to launch it in the market in about 7 months. And we've been in the market now for about 6 months. And we sell through our website and we sell through Amazon. And I can't give too many specifics, but I will tell you it's been wildly successful in terms of exceeding our expectations. And it is being distributed through digital channels. Mm-hmm. It's sold through digital channels exclusively. And all of the manufacturing is basically contracted. So it's a full end-to-end virtual organization that has an exclusive product. It's really been very exciting and is not something that I think could have been done even 10 years ago.
And it couldn't have been done because?
Couldn't have been done 10 years ago because it was 10 years ago impossible to identify contract manufacturers who had the infrastructure mm-hmm. to be able to acquire the ingredients. We worked with the contract manufacturer to manufacture the proprietary ingredient. Mm-hmm. We worked with a network of designers to develop the packaging and the design. We worked with a network to develop the actual bottles and pumps.
Yes.
Used in. And all of these individuals, our communication when we were going through this was at the height of COVID. Mm-hmm. There was no travel. There was no need for travel. It was all done through the internet and email mm-hmm. communication. And the systems that they have on their side in order to be able to perfect a 64th of an inch where the copy goes on a box and be able to do quality checking and all the good stuff that you need to make sure you have a great product is able to be done in a distributed fashion, which decreases the need for a lot of what the historical capital requirements were for launching these new types of businesses.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to go there in terms of the capital efficiency of this and the relative risk, right? You've got a lot more visibility into your demand curve before you start making more investment. Is that a fair assertion?
You absolutely do. And then once you identify the beginnings of what your demand is, you have the ability to work on the marketing side. After you have the product, you have the ability on the marketing side to do testing and learning through multiple digital channels, whether it's Yahoo search or Google search. They provide you with real-time information as to where people are searching for your product. What words do they associate it with? You may have in your mind a set of meanings around your brand, yes. but when you look at the actual searches that generate sales, you might understand new needs that your product is filling in the marketplace very, very quickly. And you can pivot to lean into those areas that are really growing and be able to deploy your marketing dollars much, much more efficiently than I think you probably ever could in the history of marketing.
I would think it's much more computable, I mean, than it ever has been. I mean, the stimulus response and the actual movement of the sales process to the stimulus, you know what I mean? Like we just talked about in the market space course, right? That stuff's going to collapse. It's fascinating. I'm reminded of that book, Everybody Lies. I don't know if you've seen that book about like what people actually search for in Google.
Yeah. I have it right here.
Yeah. We'll leave it at that, but I recommend it to all of you. Some interesting insights in there. But yes, this notion of actual behavior being very different. You know, going back to something you said a while ago, and one of the things that my partner, Sean Johnson, does is he launches new products for companies. And there are two things that we're talking about. One is that what you're saying about when you're designing the interface environment and reaction environment, to your point, it's the experience of the individual. And that's the social cognitive social experience of what the world is thinking about your product or service, right? Those two things together. And they're both contexts. And I remember back to the very early research at MIT where they were some of the folks who created the first music recommendation algorithms and so forth, the MIT Media Lab, and some of the MP3 and MP4 standards. Andy Lippman actually is one of the guys who built some of this stuff. And in the very early experiments, when they had people choosing music by samples and their preference versus choosing music by samples, their preference and other people's downloads, that is just simple frequency, that this many people like this. In that simple experiment, it moved 50% of the demand to those things that were already popular. So, I mean, 50%. And that was without all the sophistication we have now about pushing people in different directions and so forth. And it moved a full 50% just on frequency counts with in a controlled environment where you have sample versus sample, sample versus sample plus frequency, and half the volume moved. So, I mean, the power of that. So that's one thing. The second thing, and I'd be curious if you found this to be true too. It's weird. I think when companies go to get help in this area, the thing that struck me is that a lot of the help seems to be vertically sliced. And what I mean by that is it doesn't go across the full sales funnel. And I think there are some exceptions to that. You and I have talked about some, but that really engineer what you and I used to call experience engineering, right? The whole experience from stimulation, browsing in the OODA loop sense, observation, the orientation, to deciding to acting, that full loop, it seems like there aren't a lot of providers that help that way. Is that a true statement, or it's just on average people aren't, but there are plenty of ones out there that do?
On average, there are not a lot of large scale providers who can provide that end to end for midsize or small brands, I would say for sure. For large brands, where there is an existing demand curve, you can engage really large agencies to provide services. Mm-hmm. And the brand management functions of those large agencies and the brand management functions of the CPGs, it's a different game because they are so embedded into the retail distribution. Mm-hmm. Where it changes is when you get into these businesses that are really focusing on more, you know, digital awareness and digital distribution. Mm-hmm. You will find that there are not a lot of scale players in that horizontal who can offer that horizontal capacity. But you can also find that there are great players that are highly niche in each one of those areas. So we, for example, we work with a great search engine marketing agency. We work with a great agency that helps us manage our Amazon experience. We work with a great agency to help us on managing our influencer relationships. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, in the digital space, there's a lot of technology that's moving around.
Yes.
But what's so important is from the user experience design perspective is to have a strategy and perspective of the brand.
Yes.
That they want to enforce on all of these service providers. Mm-hmm. And be consistent across each of them. Mm-hmm. Because once they're in tune with where you want to go with your brand, you can really unlock a lot of exponential power in the digital network.
Sure.
or in the social network. I mean, that is a real benefit.
Yeah, fascinating. One of the things that, you know, I it's funny. I remember back in the 1980s. I don't know why it was the 1980s. It got very popular to talk about the virtual corporation, right? You're not going to own anything. Everything's going to be digital, and you're going to put stuff together. I mean, it seems like that's what you're doing, right? I mean, you are the virtual corporation, and in a weird way, it. And tell me if you agree. Well, I think you do because you and I talked a little bit about it. Whereas before, you spent the capital, the effort, the talent, and so forth, vertically integrating, building supply, building prototypes, getting stuff in front of customers, getting trial, all that other stuff, right? So very much owned. And now you're taking all that effort, you're buying that from the cloud, if you will, whether it's a physical cloud or whatever. And good job buying enough bottles for your thing before the supply chain problems hit. Because as we're saying, that's the downside of this thing. You're taking that effort that was spent on capital and building and all that other stuff. And it seems like you're much more of a systems integrator, if you will, a brand experience manager, that kind of thing, and making sure that these different suppliers that are the Lego blocks are making the right castle.
I think that's absolutely right. We definitely see the company as a team effort, and we see it as a team, but we see it as a team made up of both suppliers who are experts in their vertical area.
Right.
And experts who are part of the gig economy, so to speak. And there are so many talented people out there, and there are so many talented vendors out there who are really focused on a functional area that if you can manage them in concert with each other, you really can create opportunity to scale. I think one of the questions that we think about a lot is at what point do we build more internal capabilities,
yes,
right? When do you go from 1.5 people to 2.5 people or to 10 people, right? It's a great question.
1.5, it's easy to double the size, you know.
Right? It's very easy, but 200% growth. When do you do that? And what is the strategic, what is the strategic imperative to make it happen, right?
Yep.
What line do you need to cross before you start doing those types of investments?
Yeah.
And I think even with our small business, we're thinking about that all the time. But in the meantime, yes, we are integrating together a full customer experience, and it's particularly effective because the product is great.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
I think this model gets wobbly if it's a commodity or yes. if it's something that is purely a branding exercise. If something is more based on a specific influencer, or if it's a commoditized generic product that's simply having somebody's name slapped on it, that's a different go-to-market strategy than if you have a product which is differentiated and has something that's proprietary.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. I know you and I had a little conversation about Amazon. So our first guest on the Growth Innovator series was a guy named Rob Spivey, is a dear friend, and they do a lot of great work. I think I've shown you some of the work that on looking at the true economic value add of a company using uniform accounting and looking at those over time. They have a 20-year panel. Anyway, I think it's fantastic. And one of the things we're talking about is that if you look at Amazon's return on assets, which has been fantastic over the years, one of the ways that the folks at Valens, and I agree with, think that people a lot of time when they talk about Amazon, talk about the retail apocalypse. Okay, great. Yes, retail, that plus COVID's been a horror show for a lot of retail. But the folks at Valens say, hey, it's the CPG apocalypse, because when you look at Amazon Basics, just like Walmart did with their store brands, right? They come into certain CPG categories, consumer package categories, and just use their with a high quality supply chain that for generics, right? Come in and just basically say, thank you very much, Procter & Gamble. We'll just take that Tide margin and give a third of it back to the consumer and keep two thirds for Walmart, right? And that Amazon's doing a similar thing. You and I had a conversation about that. I think, as I remember, you're worried about that, yes, for commodities, but for a product like yours, which is highly differentiated, you go, that's not my problem. Is that fair?
It's absolutely fair. Amazon as an aggregator of demand has an enormous audience of consumers who are in the mindset of purchasing a product to fulfill a need. And it is highly, highly qualified. It's basically taking a very large demand set and putting a search filter on it. And so if you have something that is differentiated, you have the ability to do something tremendous very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. Long term, for commodity players, it's tough, right? If you're selling USB cables, your margin is going to be driven down.
Yeah, although I did read that USB cables, because of the supply chain problems, Tesla has people running out and actually buying USB cables from Best Buy and things like that to make Tesla model, whatever. But yes, except for the supply chain problems.
I'm not sure how comforting that is to drive with a Best Buy USB cable, but not my Tesla. But yes, you're right. Certainly supply shocks can create value. Long term.
Yeah.
Where there is brand loyalty, where there's brand distinction, there is protection from Amazon coming in. And when there is some kind of unique property, there is protection. And in my, again, this is I've seen companies avoid Amazon like the plague. Mm-hmm. And there are people who just believe that it is damaging to the brand. In my opinion, there is no question that as needs have broadened and consumer expectations have broadened to include a very large swath of products and consumer products,
yeah.
Amazon is basically representative of a pool of demand.
Mm-hmm.
And it needs to be managed. But I think there was a lot more damage or reasonable fear of damage related to Amazon 10 years ago than there is today. Today, I think that we're a luxury brand. We're an expensive product. And we have been pleasantly surprised by our ability to engage with consumers on Amazon in a meaningful way that have disposable income and are in the mindset of shopping.
That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, let's turn a little bit to there are some brands here that I wanted to just put up. And these are largely digitally native brands. And I know that you're familiar with many of them. And I'm sure this is part of the Salzinger family office approach here, that you're going to hit one of those numbers. But tell us a bit about how you think about, because I know there's a story under each of these, how you think about Hims and Hers and Honest and Oatly and so forth.
Sure. Each one of these businesses has a different story, is located in a different place, but they have a thread that goes across. So for example, Oatly, you may be aware that I think Oprah and Jay-Z recently invested in their last round of financing. They're an oat milk company, and they've been growing tremendously. Honest Company, was one of the co-founders was Jessica Alba, the famous actress model. Warby Parker was started out of a University of Pennsylvania dorm room. It's an eyeglasses business. Hims and Hers was a male enhancement product that was launched through digital, again, by some millennials. And when you look at all of these businesses, what they have in common is they have a tremendous digital experience, each one of them. They are engaging with their consumers through Instagram, Twitter, Pinterest. They are providing meaningful authenticity, authentic stories through social media, through their web presence. Mm-hmm. They are focused on using digital to build their brand, mm-hmm. each one of these businesses. And the teams that are behind them are dedicated to think about building their brand as digital first. Mm-hmm. And they are all going against major CPGs. And mm-hmm. I would say that the share that they have there, that market valuation, mm-hmm. Is coming directly out of the enterprise value of their competitor set. Yes. Because they're playing in the digital space and the other guys are playing catch up.
It's interesting you say that, because a lot of times as the attackers, sometimes I think you put it brilliantly, which is the comparison set is the people are attacking. And a lot of times from any of the traditional metrics for a larger company, right, they get more emphasis, right? I mean, in terms of valuation compared to revenue and profitability, they usually don't get a pass on growth. They have to be growing like crazy, right? But that whole notion that the attacker gets some of the a lot of the market value of the one being attacked, as soon as people get convinced that the model is going to be a winning model. And of course, there's volatility in that. And there's some people win and lose. And so on average, it's not as good as just a single thing, but it's amazing dynamics. And I know that you've worked for, you know, a number of larger companies. And actually with some of the folks here in the audience, I've worked with some of the large CPG companies. And it's one of those things that it's like watching them look at these digital brands. It's like watching me watch Michael Jordan play basketball. It's like, yeah, they're like, yeah, I want that. And they go out and they get a basketball and they get a basketball hoop. And you know what? They never turn it to Michael Jordan. And funny thing about that. I mean, I'm being facetious, but not really. I mean, do you think that that's just, hey, I mean, you look at something like the Kind Bar, and there's a lot of food companies that wish they did that. And you look at Dollar Shave Club, and you look at how that got purchased by Unilever for, well, I think it was $1.2 billion when they had $165 million in revenue. So what's your sense of where that market is right now? I know you're busy growing your brand, but you still have quite a sensitive ear to the ground. What's your sense of, are the big companies getting their act together to be able to be more Michael Jordan-like?
I don't think there is a large CPG in the world today that hasn't set aside a pool of capital to attack this as both an investor, so they can get insight in terms of what's going on in the marketplace. They've set aside a pool of capital to build digital centers of excellence where they can build internal capabilities. They've put aside a pool of capital to engage with digital agencies in order to support their brands. I think they're spreading their chips all over the table. And I think the success of it will be uncertain, uh-huh. Because of the nature of the hedges that are out there. I think there are certain brands that will do well, and there are certain brands that will not. And the logical question for that is what will determine who will do well and who will do not, mm-hmm. who will not do well? I would say it foundationally comes down to having a brand vision that you can easily or at least strategically connect into a digital growth plan. Mm-hmm. Many brand visions never get translated into digital. They are a brand and they just try and take an offline brand approach and plug it into digital and see if it works. Mm-hmm. I could think of a lot of consumer electronics companies do that, for example.
Name one or two of you that you look at and you say, wow, that's simply a line of new bottles here.
Yeah, no. So if you look at like Panasonic, that Panasonic is one that like comes to my mind, uh-huh. right? They're in the business of manufacturing televisions. They have a traditional way of developing screens. They uh-huh. feel that they're in a commodity business. Uh-huh. They rely on distribution partners to basically monetize any incremental digital spend. Mm-hmm. So if you're buying a Panasonic television on Amazon, you're probably buying a Panasonic television through a distributor right. of the company. And they don't have a brand that has any particular meaning beyond the specifications of their particular device. Or, you know, it could be a television, it could be a phone, it could be a hairdryer. It's commodity to the manufacturer. Mm-hmm. Whereas those other brands, every day, what do they think about? They think about how are they going to engage with their mm-hmm. customer, with their loyal user? What are they going to do to get them to buy more? And they are trying to build that direct relationship and do it in concert with their distribution relationships. So they feed off each other. Mm-hmm. And when you do create that kind of robust, virtuous cycle, you create some tremendous value. And it's not easy for a company that simply views itself as a manufacturer reliant on distribution mm-hmm. to make that cultural and emotional shift, and frankly, to attract the talent that can be successful inside a very large manufacturing organization.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, if you look at the market and you look at CPGs, consumer packaged goods in general, there's always been a lot of interest by private equity, and there's been more right lately. And as the whole market continues to go less and less public and more toward private equity, do you think, and I remember reading a book by, I forget the guy's name, he's from McKinsey, it was Attacker's Advantage. He basically said, if you look at companies that have transformed themselves significantly, and he had a good definition for it, very few companies do it. I don't know, 1 in 10 or something, but it's three times as likely if they're privately owned to make that transformation. So you look at Clayton, Dubilier & Rice when they bought the old typewriter division of IBM and they turned it into Lexmark, the printing company, right? That's three times as likely to happen if it's privately controlled. I don't know if those stats are still the same now, but it's a long-winded way to say, do you think private equity is going to be the ones that transform these dinosaurs from buying sweaters to actually becoming mammals?
Well, I think it's important in the context of private equity to understand what the mission of private equity is. The mission of private equity is value creation based on an underwriting thesis and exit in 5 to 7 years. The ability to do some of these transformations may fall outside of that time horizon. And so I think there are certain brands where there's the ability to set it up for success, which yeah. could then enable a transaction for the next owner to realize the value creation, but also be responsible for the execution. Because many times you'll never get the opportunity because the hold period is too short. So I think that absolutely private equity plays a role in the ecosystem for certain companies and certain yeah. types of brands. But there are other types of brands that it's not an appropriate type of capital partner. Right. And they can benefit from the resources that can be brought from a large CPG. So I hate to say it, it depends. Yeah. That answer, I know.
Yeah, but I thought that was interesting what you say about the transformation period for many CPG brands, maybe more than 5 to 7 years. I mean, that was certainly my belief when 3G bought Kraft. I mean, I talked to Betsy Holden one time. She was the person who built the Tombstone Pizza. And to get that crust, that inflatable crust that really gives you more of the pizza shop taste out of just anybody's oven, it took them 10 years of R&D to make that crust, right? And so, as you say, that wouldn't fit in a whole period. And so, interesting, you're saying digital may have, for certain brands, may have that same kind of gestation period. And no,
absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We got a question, I see. So I was going, I can address that question, which is, do you think CPG companies will be able to attract, develop, and retain enough digital talent to scale consistently and introduce and market innovative, distinctive products? So it's a great question. So I think when we talked about how CPG companies are approaching and the many different ways they're doing it through investment, through setting up digital centers of excellence, and through up training their existing teams, part of it always involves bringing new talent into the organization. Into each one of those three, there is bringing new talent into the organization. And so with acquisitions, as you've seen, I think Unilever's done a bunch of these, you basically think of it about like what Accenture does or PwC when they buy a digital agency, right? What these CPGs are doing is they're buying the talent,
right?
And they're bringing them in. And if anybody wants to buy RescueMD, give me a call, right? It's one of those things, right, where you can basically do these acqui-hires of the expertise. In the digital center of excellence, what you're seeing now versus what you're seeing even 10 years ago is that I'm going to date myself, right? We worked together a long time ago, but you're seeing that millennials are really moving into that bracket of both experience set and spend, yeah, discretionary income, mm-hmm, where the digital centers of excellence are now people in their 20s, because they know things that people in their 30s don't.
Right.
And so you're seeing, you know, a lot of turnover there. And then in terms of the upscaling part of it, in terms of the internal pieces, that is basically probably the most difficult to transform, to attract and develop and retain talent, which is like your existing organization. Uh-huh. And the most likely scenario, I think, long-term that happens in your internal team is turnover. Uh-huh. Where you see it most clearly is typically when an organization, CPG, goes from managing an SAP implementation. This is going to sound a little bit off the beaten track, but it's directly relevant. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of folks who go from like an SAP Business One to a NetSuite. Mm-hmm. So they basically switch their whole accounting system. And the one thing that in my years of looking at this that I've seen is that pretty much the entire accounting department, with the exception of probably one or two people, whenever that transition happens, turns mm-hmm. over. And they bring in people who know how to use NetSuite. And they bring in people who are familiar with the reporting and familiar with the analysis that management needs in order to take advantage of it. What you don't see on the digital marketing side is the same type of commitment to bringing on the talent that knows how to use the tools.
Fascinating.
Maybe not an easy thing to do,
yep,
but I think it is something that you see much more clearly in the finance area than you see in the marketing area. In my opinion, marketing often needs to turn over mm-hmm. in order to be able to start to attract and retain the talent.
That's like that old yarn. You want change management? Change management. Right. It's like, yeah, change up the talent. We have a question about the untapped consumer trends that we're seeing, especially in retail and direct consumer spaces. I would say on the retail side that true integration of physical and virtual is still got a long way to go. I mean, you look at two great retailers, Whole Foods and Walmart, and I would say that my digital continuity coming from Amazon into Whole Foods is much greater and much better than my digital continuity from my Walmart.com experience into the Walmart store. I think I could say that for just about every retailer I walk into, not just the ones in the ropes like Macy's and so forth. But I would say that is one thing that we're just at the very beginning of that integration and that continuity. We're seeing financial services. I mean, you know, financial services, still the ATM. I mean, the ATM's from last century. You know, you walk in, your digital experience compared to like what you have on your phone. I mean, there's just not that kind of continuity. Not true in parts of Asia. Citibank Japan, for example, has very innovative place-based integration. But Citibank US, not so much. So I'd say that's one trend. Steve, what do you think?
Probably the one that I have seen that is fascinating and early to me is the buy now, pay later trend, where you are starting to see payment mechanisms, whether it's Shopify Pay, Afterpay, Klarna, which are basically the ability to get the money from you in a creative way, to get the money into your bank account. All of those shops, or I should say all of those payment systems, are now starting to build connections to retail brands and shops.
Yes.
And so they're all in this position of saying, well, payment first, now let's integrate into a website. You're seeing it with Google, you're seeing it with a little bit less so with Bing and Microsoft, but you are, if you think about it in aggregate, these payment mechanisms have the ability to potentially develop the same kind of shopping experiences that Amazon currently has. And I think long-term, the more closely you integrate payment into websites, the more easily you can actually develop emerging competitors for Amazon.
It's fascinating you said, Steve. I was just on a call with a friend, Chris Bonsomino, who was a diamond guy, and then he went to work for Visa for a while, and is now got a startup called Flow. And what he's essentially doing, how there's that those German brothers who basic billionaires who take ideas from the Western markets and then move them east or whatever. They play business model arbitrage, right? So first Uber in Holland, right, or whatever, and then they get acquired. Well, he's doing the same thing in payments. And if you look at what payments look like in China, you not only get the receipt and so forth, you have an engagement experience when you do the payment. It's not like the PayPal experience that we have here, right, on your mobile device. And he's creating that platform, Flow, to be able to have different engagement mechanisms and also give the receipt back and go to the card issuers and have that happen. So that moment of payment is now a whole engagement platform. And he's just taking stuff he's seen work well for hundreds of millions of people in China and bringing it to the Western markets. So it's interesting. One last question from Jim Ceriello, because I know we've got about 3 minutes left. So if you give a short answer to what would you have done differently in the consumer product was a connected product, throwing off data.
Throwing off data. Well, frankly, I wish it was. That's a great question. So what would I have done differently if it was a connected product? So as an electronic, you know, anything that's a connected product. Well, you know what? I'm going to answer it differently. Any product can be a connected product. It is possible to increasingly develop tools and devices to apply skincare and help people maintain a specific routine. And this is something in healthcare that's happening in a big way right now, where people are, the pharma companies and the CVSs of the world are investing in these technologies in order to help people adhere to their routines and their medical routines, skincare routines, or what have you. So I think in terms of what you do differently, it's just adding another layer of data to the consumer experience and making sure that it is user-friendly, because it would require, right now, the interface to a consumer for a consumer product is basically the account you log into when you go to my website or when you log into Amazon. The difference would be you would have more data available, and you need to make sure that it's not overwhelming for the individuals. Maybe it pings their cell phone, but whatever it is that you are doing to connect the product, make sure you do it from the perspective of having as little interference with the consumer experience as possible. And make sure you maintain the data securely and with a lot of privacy on your own time. So
thank you, Steve. All right. With that, thank you. I can't thank you enough, man. It's great to be with you as always. And we have to do this more often. So thank you, everyone. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode. For more information and advice on how to become a growth innovator in your own organization, visit us at manifold.group. And if you enjoyed this episode, we would love a review on iTunes, Spotify, or whichever platform you use. Thanks as always for listening. We will see you next time.